Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with greed. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and I need to get something off my chest right away as we get started. Before we move into the fun part of the show, where we have a conversation with our good friend Michael Cornacia, I just want to touch just ever so slightly on something that's I'm going to be honest, very dark, and it is not going to be fun. But I think it's important to address these things as they happen. I don't know, this one's really affecting me a lot, for reasons that I'll get into. When I was 9 years old, I left a suicide note in a library book, and I was making plans to hang myself, and I thought, if I leave the note in a library book, they'll find it later, and then they'll know, like someone will find it later. I don't really know what I was doing exactly. I just knew that there was something in me that the sadness just wouldn't go away. And I didn't know anything about bipolar. I didn't know anything about depression. All I knew was sadness. I was fucking 9 years old. I couldn't really navigate the world with any sort of assurance. I barely knew who I was or what I wanted. I just wanted all of it to stop. I didn't want to feel like that anymore. And that was the only thing I could think of to make it all go away. And I wasn't a well-liked kid. I was a weird kid, for a lot of reasons. And I got lucky that I was allowed to make so many mistakes and that I was allowed to learn from it and figure out how to navigate the world after you've been shamed and physically beaten up and, belittled by teachers and adults even, and had your dignity stripped away from you by bullies. And you get up and you go on. And then as you get older, you learn how little any of those things mean. But this kid, this Jamel Miles, 9-year-old boy in Denver, Colorado, has killed himself after his first week of fourth grade because the kids were bullying him. And it turns out bullying him maybe because he was going to come out to them as gay, to live his truth as he knew it so far. And, to have that kind of presence of mind at that age, when you're already so vulnerable and you're already in such a place where it's so easy to feel insecure and small about things because you haven't built up the emotional armor. My heart goes out to this kid. My heart goes out to the family, who, by all accounts, from what I can tell, did all the right things. They did everything that a parent should do. You're always second-guessing yourself. It's so easy to look back on everything you did, at and around your children, thinking, how is this going to affect them later in life? And then, this kid makes a decision like this, and I don't know. It just breaks my heart, and I feel like, if there's people in your life that you think might need a life preserver, but you're nervous about reaching out to them, don't be so nervous. Just reach out. Just check in. Just let them know that there's a world outside of their own shit. You know, the things that you're dealing with tend to go away. They tend to get better. And as far as life is concerned, it's definitely better after 9 years old. It definitely is. It's better after 20. It's better after 30. I'm hoping it's better after 40. The jury's still out. I'm still kind of feeling my way through it. So far, so good. Knock on wood, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like it's necessary to hear about things like this because we need to understand that this is still out there in the world. There are still people who don't understand that thoughts like this affect a lot of people, even kids. And we've got to do better. That's all I'm going to say on this right now. But we've got to do better. Today on the show, we have Michael Cornacchia. He's an actor out of Los Angeles, California. He has been on things like The Tick, 6 Feet Under, Pushing Daisies, CSI New York, Batman, Arkham video games. I mean, his voice has been in everything. His face has been in everything. He's one of the most amazing people I know. Just a genuinely solid, friendly, great guy who unfortunately also has kind of a tragic story of his own to tell. But I'm going to let him tell it. So let's talk to Michael Cornacchia. Right off the goddamn bat, I have to start by making this weird. Because, as you know, because you were there, you and I met back in, I want to say it was 1997?
Yeah, 97, 98.
Yeah, it was right around there. And a guy by the name of Matt Shutt was trying to make a film in Los Angeles. And there were a lot of people in there. Well, yeah. But there were a lot of people there that had, you know, headshots and credits and things like that. And then he brings in this guy from Michigan who's a friend of his who's never been in front of a camera in his life and says, "Why don't you take the lead?"
Yeah. I love Matt.
Yeah, I love him too, but I gotta ask, because you and I had some scenes together, and we spent just a little bit of time together here and there, you know, at Marnie's and whatnot, but how, if that pissed you off that you were second banana to somebody so green, you were so nice about it, and you didn't let it show at all.
No, dude. In fact, I was just really excited to be there. I just graduated college. I was getting my acting reel put together. And back then, we put them all on these things called VHSs, you know?
Yeah.
And I had a couple commercials under my belt, a couple credits. And I went to Matt because he was at this local editing bay.
Yeah.
And he looked at my, he was helping me edit my reel, and he's like, "Hey, man, I'm making this movie. Would you want to be in it?" And I was like, "All right." I mean, that was really it. So I didn't really expect to be the lead or anything else, and I really liked the part that he had me do, and I thought you were great. I thought everyone was really cool. I mean, he was, all of Matt's projects are extremely ambitious, as you know.
Yeah.
And this was the first of many ambitious projects, so I had no problem at all. I thought it was actually awesome. In fact, out of most of the things I've done in my life, that one I actually remember them a lot of, which is rare that I don't really remember too many projects I started doing and I forget about them.
Well, I mean,
but I guess maybe it was one of the first ones.
Well, yeah. And also it was, I mean, everybody was there because they wanted to be. You know, I mean, which not to say, not to cast aspersions on anything else that you've done, but I mean, there is a difference when everybody is still really hungry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And everybody is working together to help make it be a better project. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, because everybody had more than one job. Everybody had to pay attention to everybody else's lines.
Recently, you know, you got to know that the work you did in the recent project I've done with Matt, that Newsnight Tomorrow, is fantastic, man. All those characters you played with that religious bit, it was really well done. I was peeing my pants, especially the outtake.
Yeah, I really loved doing it. I thought that was really fun. That was a real blast to be involved with. You know, when he asked me if I wanted to do it, he didn't even tell me what it was. He just asked me if I wanted to do some stuff, and I said, yeah, anything. And then I got costumes in the mail.
Yeah. He did. He shipped you the costumes. That's incredible.
Yeah. Of course he did. Of course he did. He sent me the costumes, and then, you know, he sent me some sort of cryptic text. You know, I've got these, and I'm on my way with a Bible, a stopwatch, and a jar of mayonnaise. Don't ask why.
Yes, yeah, everyone else is shipping out marijuana in the mail in California and not shipping out costumes and props. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. He's just that kind of guy. But I really, one of the things I remembered specifically about that time, because I was really nervous. You know, I figured out kind of what I was doing sort of halfway through by watching everybody else. Like, oh, don't be quite so big. Don't be such a stage guy. And I kind of tried to pay attention to everybody, and I got better as I went by paying attention. But one of the things that I was immediately jealous the first day that we worked together, because your timing was so insanely tight.
Yeah. My timing is impeccable.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know that you're a Philly guy.
Yes.
So when did you go from Philly to L.A.?
Well, I knew I wanted to come out to L.A. to be an actor. So I went to USC, and I knew that if I went to college out here, I'd get a better understanding. I'd have a better base. And then, like, going to a college on the East Coast and eventually having to come out here. It's like, well, just go out there now, you know? So I moved out when I was 18, and pretty much, you know, I knew I wanted to stick around. I studied theater at the USC School of Theater. A lot of the kids I met when I was 18, I'm still friends with today. They're adults. They have kids. I've done TV shows with them, movies with them, sketches with them. So, you know, I pretty much knew when I was a child that this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so now I don't know if it's still what I want to do, but I definitely love it. And right now I'm still doing it. And but, you know, as you get older, you start to see other things out there. And, you know, when you start working in something that you love, you end up not really loving it.
So, yeah. Your fun is work.
You know,
now.
It's like, that's why I never would want to get a job. I never want to get a job at Disneyland. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, exactly.
But it's also changed a lot. It's definitely a very different industry. Like, I came in when I was a kid in the 80s, you know, sitcoms were huge. I watched them all. I loved them all. I mean, you talk about my timing. I studied them. You know, my father was very funny. Very funny. His humor was very smart, very dry. So I would watch him. You know, he was no stretch entertainer whatsoever, but he was just really just a funny person. And he got me involved with, as a young kid, he got me in Hello, which was on First. And then obviously Cheers was a gigantic hit when we were growing up.
Yeah.
He was a big Burns and Allen fan. So I'd watch George Burns and Grace Allen. And that was the type of, you know, and I grew up loving doing theater. And, you know, I studied theater when I went to college. Now it's not even called theater. It's called dramatic arts because of the internet and all these little shows, you know, sketches. And so it's a very different industry. I'm not trying to be like a bah humbug kind of person saying, you know, back in my day, we actually acted. But yeah, back in my day, we actually acted.
Yeah.
But, you know, just like anything else, it's evolving. I tell people, think about paintings. When paintings first were invented, when people first developed paints and canvases or whatever the hell it was, oil or what, it was very difficult, I'm sure, to get. So really experienced or wealthy people have the ability to paint. Now you can go into any grocery store, CVS, and get a little thing of paint and some paper and paint yourself. That's what's happening with the film industry.
Oh,
everyone's got their phone. Everyone's got their camera. Everyone has a way to broadcast themselves through YouTube, Vimeo, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever the hell is coming out next. So everyone has the ability to be their own Martin Scorsese. Now, not everyone will be Martin Scorsese, but it disallows more people to have the chance to show people what they're doing rather than waiting in line and getting an agent and then having to wait in line and get on a network and then waiting in line to get on actual television. You know, so, I mean, I tell people, I knew I wanted to be an actor, so I left my family 3,000 miles when I was 18, came out here, studied theater, got a night job so I could get an audition during the day, got into the union, started working in TV and film, and then I turned around, and before I knew it, all these kids were famous because they had little YouTube channels, and they were showing people how to put makeup on in the basement of their parents' house. So,
well, right, but I mean, to be fair, there's also a lot of YouTube videos of, you know, people getting hit in the balls, and I mean, but how do you parlay that into a career?
People are. As long as you have eyes, it's all about average. All about what is not most entertaining. What are people watching? It doesn't necessarily need to be entertained. As long as they're watching it, I mean, to a degree, obviously that's entertaining, but you know, maybe they've got to just have their eyes on it. And that's what the name of the game is always been. You know, oh, I really like watching this. Well, if you like watching this, I need to make sure my product is in there somewhere so that everyone can see that product.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's how they're making money. I mean, I went to a meeting with VH1 a few months ago, and the development guy there was like, look, we're trying to get YouTube people on TV. And when they hear TV, they get super excited because obviously they all want to be on TV. But then when they see what they get on TV versus what they're getting at YouTube, there's no comparison. They just don't have a reason to go to television other than being on television, which honestly is not as a big deal these days anymore, at least in my opinion.
But it is also a different kind of work. I mean, it depends on what your goals are. If your goals are simply to get notoriety and get famous, there's easier ways to do it than to become an actor.
Yes, exactly. there's two, you know, you want to make a living, you want to be famous, you want to, you know, have your art. There's so many reasons to be in this business. I think if you want to be famous, that's the worst reason.
Yeah.
If you want to be famous but you love the art, you know, because when I was, who the hell doesn't want to be famous when they think of Hollywood? No, you go to 80s and all this. But that's also a big, that's also perception. You know, I'm on a bunch of commercials. I mean, I did a commercial a couple of years ago for Little Caesars, and, you know, I got paid shit for it because the union is not really, we're not doing many, commercials aren't being done by the Screen Actors Guild much anymore.
Yeah.
There was a big strike in 2000, and it sort of showed the companies, the corporations who make the commercials that they can make them without union actors.
So I saw that commercial.
15 years. Yeah. And that was a non-union, you know, I went FICOR, which the union hates. I know, but I had to do it to try to make some extra coin because, you know, they were not making that many union spots.
Yeah.
And everyone back home was like, oh my God, I saw you. And anytime I've been on television or something, you know, they just, and I appreciate it. Don't get me wrong. It's really nice to hear that and you know, for people too. But at the end of the day, it's like my head's just floating around a slice of pizza. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like other people we went to high school with, they're doctors, they're brain scientists, they're rocket scientists, you know. So, but that television really makes people think if you're on it, you did something right.
Yeah. It's weird,
day,
right?
If you're on it, what's that?
I say it's weird, right?
It's very weird.
Like everybody back home, I bet they were excited. But at the same time, it's like that was just you sitting on a soundstage somewhere with a green screen behind you for 4.5 hours. And maybe they fed you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they have to feed you. But yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know. Exactly. No, 100%. But, you know, honestly, like I said, it's all perception. It's all what you want out of it. You know, I always said yes to everything.
Yeah.
And maybe that wasn't the best idea, but I always liked being on, you know, back in my 20s and 30s, I really liked just doing working. And I liked, even if it didn't pay or if it did pay, you know, or if it was a sketch where I used to do all these really funny sketches for G4 TV. mm-hmm. which was back in the day at Gamer Network. I don't know if you heard of it, but it was like I used to do. My buddy was a host on it, so he used to bring me in all the time. And those were some of the greatest things I did. My other friend is that I didn't go to college with, but I met him outside of college. He's friends from college through sketch group we did. He invented that character Kelly, which was one of the very first YouTube viral videos.
Yeah,
he dressed up like a young girl and he sang about shoes.
Yes,
and, like, you know, he used to make videos all the time. And he was one of the first people who was like, let me get a camera. Let me shoot some stuff. Let me put it online. And people really liked it. And Kelly blew up. And because of Kelly having a huge following, he needed to put more content on his YouTube page. So he and our other friend developed this character or this, you know, Heather's vlog. It was about a vampire daughter who would do vlogs about being a vampire with her father. And I played the father. And I mean, that was one of the greatest things I've ever done in my career. I barely got any money. I mean, people would hire us here and there to do, because it got pretty popular to do, like, to promote their stuff. But, yeah. You know, I did tons of those videos for nothing. But it's some of my best work because, you know, I worked with Megan Perry, who is a brilliant comedian, a brilliant actress and improviser, and Liam Sullivan, who was Kelly. I mean, it was just genius every time we got together. So, to be said, I just love doing it. Anytime it was fun and looked good, I would just do it. You know, I'm not that kind of way anymore, but back then, certainly.
Well, and I remember seeing you on the TV all the time. It was kind of a strange thing because I'd be sitting at home watching television, and then there's Michael again.
You'll hear my voice.
Yeah,
people always say, "I hear your voice." I'll be in the bathroom, and all of a sudden, I'll hear your voice, and I ran up. You know, and I had my brother once was sleeping and he thought I was over. So he went outside to the living room and his roommate, he said to his roommate, "Is Michael here?" He goes, "No, but I just killed him in this video game."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what kind of a mind fuck is that? You know, it's I haven't seen you in forever. And then I'm sitting on my couch playing a Batman game and Michael Cornacchia shows up.
Yeah. And my voice is extremely distinct. So there's no question it's me.
Yeah, there's never any question really, that it's you. I got to tell you, one of my favorite tiny things that you ever did that was such a small thing, one of my favorite things ever, it just destroys me with laughter every time I see it, was Kid Caboose on The Tick.
Oh, God. Yeah, The Tick, man.
Oh.
Wow. The original Tick. They tried to remake that again this year, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. The Amazon bought that.
That was such a crazy experience. It was one of my first gigs, and I played Kid Caboose, and that was Fox had picked it up, and the series was, like, super expensive.
Yeah.
So, like, the guy who played Fish Boy, they only had enough makeup to make up his face and one hand for the joke about his web hand. And the other hand, they didn't make up because they didn't have the money. So they told him to keep that other hand under the table.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. But you're one of those guys. You're one of those that guys. Those guys that show up.
We
all over the place.
Yeah, we were in a sidekick. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you try. A couple years ago, a friend of mine was on a set, and they were set dressing, I guess, a desk, and they put a couple pictures up on the desk, and she looked at one of them, and it was me in the frame. And next, and she sent a picture. She snapshot it on her phone. She goes, "What the hell is this?" And I'm next to a dumpster. I have no recollection where the hell that was, when it was taken, but the fact that there's a picture of me in a frame somewhere, and it's used as a prop for set dressing. Pretty much, I think, means you've made it.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But you've done all kinds of little things. Like, you know, you were the clown on CSI. You know, ER, Pushing Daisies, and Jesus Christ.
I was one of the deaths in, God, what the hell's the show?
6 Feet Under.
6 Feet Under, yeah. There's one death. The beginning of every show, there's a death, and I was death number 54.
That show has the best.
My last name is Cornacchia, and that title of that episode was called "Grinding the Corn."
Yes, I mean you were more crushed than ground, but
and at that time, my boyfriend, I just started dating my boyfriend who I've been with for 8 years, but at that time we just started dating and we were moving in to our West Hollywood apartment. I mean, you can't get any more, you know, stereotypical than two gay guys moving into a real apartment. But the day we moved in was the night my episode of 6 Feet Under aired on HBO. And I get crushed, as you know, by a bunch of comic books in this. And yeah. my ex loved comics, was all things geek. So I was helping move tons and tons and tons and tons of comic books.
Oh my God.
Into this apartment. And I thought, oh, what if happens if I get killed and crushed just like I did in the movie? Just like I did in the TV show.
Oh my God.
So I know. Isn't that crazy?
That is so crazy. Man, how cool is it to be a part of something like that, though? I mean, that was a show that has probably today the greatest ending of any TV show I've ever seen.
Any TV show, man. Don't you still think about it sometimes?
I do. I watch that whole series beginning to end probably every 2 years and just cry.
Oh, that's a smart way to do. Well, yeah. My dad had died in the middle of that. I mean, I started watching when it first came to HBO and I loved it.
Yeah.
And then my dad died kind of tragically. And I just was like, I'm never going to be able to watch 6 Feet Under again because it's all about death. And, you know, I'd just done all that, you know. In fact, when my dad died, it was sudden and tragic. So we all had to pick up and go to Philly.
Yeah.
And when I landed, my agent called and told me I booked a National Sierra Mist commercial. So I had to basically, like, go to my dad's funeral, miss his burial, get on a plane and fly back to Paramount and shoot a commercial for Sierra Mist. But you know what? That commercial ran for a couple years. So I think my dad would have much preferred me make some coin,
yeah,
you know, than be there for his burial, which I would have lost it on. But I thought I would not be able to watch 6 Feet Under after his death. And I'll tell you what, I did. And it really rang so much more true and deeper to me.
Yeah.
That when I actually got on it, that was magical. That certainly was magical. Like walking around those sets at the Sunset Gower studio, and because I was a fan of the show, and I, this is where this happened, this is where that happened, you know, I was fanboying out, which I don't do. I don't really, I'm not a fan of that many things, you know. We did the Star Wars trilogy in 30 minutes for 10 years. Lucasfilm flew us around the country.
Yeah.
Do those plays. And I mean, I met Frank Oz, I met a bunch of people. I never really was, I even met Lucas, I was hammered, but I met him. And I never was like a fanboy until I did
right.
6 Feet Under.
Well, and you were in that documentary too, the People versus George Lucas.
Yeah, the People versus George Lucas. Yes, exactly. They interviewed us for that. Yeah.
Ah, man, what a great show! So let me ask you about this. If this isn't too much, I remember when your dad died, and I remember that you were pretty public about it. There seemed to be some tension in you about what you were going to do.
Yeah, man. My career was just getting off the ground. I'd done a pilot where I booked a series regular for a CBS sitcom. You know, my name was on the list of actors to see.
Was that the one with the blind guy?
Yeah, that was Blind Man. That was with French Stewart. French
yes,
Stewart had just
yes.
finished doing Third Rock from the Sun. They gave him Blind Men, and I booked that. I was 26. It was like unheard of. You know, it was glorious. I mean, like I told you, I was a big fan of George Burns and Grace Zhao. When I went to test for the part, I went down to the bottom of CBS Television City to audition for it, and there were all these Burns and Allen posters all over because they started that network. So I knew I booked it. As soon as I saw them all over the walls and pictures, I was like, oh, I got this. These guys are here with me. And I did. And I this huge role. Not huge, but a sitcom. It was huge. I mean, considering it was a series regular.
Yeah.
But sitcoms are like, I call them children's theater. They're like, back in the day, they were like 23 pages long. And if you were like, you know, I was the brother of the lead, so I was on like maybe a fourth of it, not even. So it was like doing children's theater. It was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, that show did not get picked up, and I was ready to jump into a next pilot season. My dad, it took his life. And he took his life because, I'll make a very long story short, obviously, he wasn't well, and he had a business, and he made a lot of money. He came from nothing. He joined he went to Vietnam on his own. He felt like it was his duty because he went into the Air Force so he could get on the GI Bill, and then the war broke out, and he felt like it was his duty to go to the war, so he did that. Met my mom a week before he went out, came back from the war a year later, married my mom, started going to college. The first person in my family to go to college, went to Temple. My mom had my sister. And then he started working, and he really worked his way up from nothing. I mean, he's worked his way up and became a really very successful businessman. We ended up moving to a really, really expensive part called the Main Line. It's the suburbs of Philly. We lived in a huge house that they custom built. he had a swimming pool, a finished basement. You know, this was because my dad grew up with my grandfather, who unfortunately his father was an alcoholic. I never knew him to be that way. By the time I remember him and had time with my grandfather, he was not an alcoholic, and I loved him. But he was drafted at 26. At 26 years of age, he was drafted. He had a pregnant wife. Man. He had two twin girls, and the government still picked his ass up and threw him to war. He lost it. He went into the Battle of the Bulge, came back an alcoholic.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And just that war ruined the family. All my dad's sisters got out of the house. When you're an Italian in South Philly, like, you couldn't leave the house unless you got married if you were a woman back then.
Yeah.
So they all got married to the first people they could. Half of them got divorced. My dad joined the Air Force at like 17 just to get the hell out of the house. And so by the time he was had us and my mom, he was super excited. Like, things were going right the way they should be. He was doing everything right. He was making the money. And then in the 90s, business changed, things moved, and his business wasn't doing well. He left the company, started his own. It did okay, then it didn't. Long story short, he ended up losing his house that he loved, and I think that really hit him, but he was stuck around, and he and my mom moved into the city, and then his business was doing okay to support them in the city. And my mom always had little side jobs here and there. But I guess it got worse again, and he had a suicide clause in his life insurance policy. And as long as he had the policy for at least 2 years, he could take his life and my mother could still benefit, you know, get the payout for it. And he had the policy since we were babies, so
yeah.
Many years. So when he was 54, he realized that once he hit 55, the premiums for this policy were going to skyrocket, you know? So he decided to take his life at 54, and he did it in a hospital so that he could donate all of his organs, and he did it so that my mother could collect, which she did, a large hefty sum of money, which she's been able to live on. And he felt like because he couldn't provide for his family, this is the best alternative. He took his life in a hospital so he could donate his organs. But this was October 23rd of 2001 when he died. And it was right after 9/11. And he took his life at, I think it was Jefferson Hospital in Philly, which is a pretty popular hospital. And he locked himself in the nursing room so no one would prevent him. But I'm sorry, the nurse's bathroom. They had their own private bathroom. And he knew about this place because his mother had been there for some procedures. So he knew the layout. He planned it. He went in there, locked himself in there, but nobody knew why that bathroom was locked. Of course, speculation was a bomb. So they had to have the bomb squad come in. By the time they got the door open and cleared my dad, his entire body had expired, so none of his organs were viable to be harvested. And
oh my God.
You know, the rest is history. It totally killed me. You know, I went from being this funny dude to being complete, like, he was the greatest person I ever met. He was supportive of everything I did, from acting to being gay, you know, and he was from South Philly. You know what I mean? And I could have had any number of men from South Philly as my dad, and they would not have been too excited about having their gay son run off to California to be an actor. But my dad was so behind me, you know. So it devastated me. It devastated everyone. He was the rock of the family. And, you know, there was a period, like, what do I do? How can I ever be funny again? And I went through my own massive depression, you know. And I went through, like, thank God I had done that pilot. So I had some health insurance through the Screen Actors Guild. So I went and saw some shrinks and some therapists. And I even went to a couple survivor suicide meetings. And then there was a humongous Believe It or Not conference, because I ended up moving back home. I couldn't audition. I was, like, crying at auditions. I was bombing them. It was terrible.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm done. I moved back home. I went to these things. I took some time off. I was like a bitch, I think. My mom, everyone was worried that I had planned on taking my life because I didn't know what to do, you know? But I just knew I couldn't because it would kill everybody even more.
Right.
My mother was like, she was devastated, but she knew she needed to be around for us. And she was. She's a fucking rock.
Yeah.
She was. So, but anyway, long story short, I went to the Survivor of Suicide meeting, and then I went to the Survivor of Suicide conference. And at that conference, everyone wore different colors on their shirts, like different stickers representing who in their life had suicided.
Yeah.
You know, it was like blue, red, pink, blue for parents, red for kids. And I remember looking around and seeing a lot of people who were like zombies. This is the death of them. And, I was like, I don't want to be that. Like, I was 27 when I went to this conference, 26 when Dad died, and 27 when I went to this conference.
Yeah.
it was just like, I cannot walk around for the rest of my life like a zombie. This is not going to be me. I mean, I'm not going to die, but I'm not going to be that.
Right.
And then something weird happened. My buddy Rawson Thurber, who is a huge movie director now, look him up. Rawson Marshall Thurber. He's like done everything. Rich, he's a really funny dude. Right before my dad died, I had done this small little short for him called Terry Tate Office Linebacker. And it ended up being that Reebok got wind of it and they wanted to turn it into a commercial. And this commercial ended up being one of the top 10 Super Bowl commercials of all time.
Yeah, I remember that.
But I didn't know when that was going to happen. And so Rawson called me up. I mean, I got the phone call that George Lucas wanted to see the Star Wars trilogy in 30 minutes up at Lucasfilm. They were flying everyone up to San Francisco to perform in front of George Lucas. And I turned that down. I said, I can't be Jabba the Hutt right now. I mean, I can't believe I did that, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't do it. And then Rawson called me and he wanted to know. Rawson called me and he wanted to know what if I was going to come and redo my part in the short for the Reebok commercial. And I was like, I don't know, man. I don't think I can do it. And he was so super sweet and he kept calling me. And he was like, just come out. You can crash on my floor. Just do the role. And I was like, And so I talked to my therapist and to my psychiatrist and I figured, okay, you know what? I'll go and do it. And I flew out to L.A., and the second the plane hit the runway or landed and I stepped outside, I felt this complete sense of calm. Like, I needed to leave L.A. for a few months so that I could come back and remember what it was like for me to reset myself.
Yeah.
And I remember driving down the freeway and just being like, oh, I'm home. And I didn't feel that incredible anxiety and despair that I felt since he had passed. And then my friend told me to come over his house, and I went over his house, and he wasn't there, so I was just waiting for him. I turned on the TV, and there was an old episode of the Burns and Allen show on television.
Oh, my God.
Which never, never have I seen an old episode in the reruns of Burns and Allen like that. You know, normally you'd see him, but it just happened to be on. And it was an episode where Gracie misinterpreted one of George's notes and thought he was going to kill himself. How fucking crazy is that?
Oh, my God.
And like hilarity ensued, and then I ended up doing the part for Rawson, and then I ended up doing, what else did I do? I ended up doing Eric McCormack from Will and Grace wrote a short film, and I ended up being the lead in that, which almost got nominated for an Oscar, got down to one of the top 25 before they picked the top, whatever, five. But I did that with Ron Livingston. And then I booked a pilot with NBC, but I was a witch. I was a male witch. It was really bad at its power. It was a sitcom. It was like Bewitched, but reversed.
Nice.
For some reason, that didn't get picked up, but whatever. But I ended up like, I got back into the swing of things. And I not over it, but I just moved on with my life.
No, well, and there isn't really, that's the thing that they can't really teach you about, is that there isn't really ever a over it. There's just a through it or around it or with it.
You end up walking around with a scar where the pain was. Because when you first hear the information, when it first tragic information like this, it takes a while for your body to digest it. My uncle said it the best. It's like having your leg ripped off. Like, you need to learn how to walk without that leg. You know, your body had that leg and then it doesn't. So, and especially with survivors of suicide, it's so sudden, you know, where one day they're there and the next day they're gone. A lot of people, if someone's dying of an illness, they have time with the person, not that they're just any better, but they do have some kind of closure.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the last thing I said to my father was. You know, it was just, it was kind of, frustrating. So, no, but you know, it's just kind of, but it's life. And as I got older, not saying life is what happens and you make other plans, I never understood it until this happened. Because everything else had been going completely on track.
Right.
You know, everyone in high school, I did all the plays in high school. Everyone in high school loved me. Came out to college. I won all these awards at college. The first audition I had, I booked. I got into the union right away. I had a couple pilot seasons under my belt. And I booked a pilot. And I booked, you know. And then when he died, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. No. This wasn't in the fucking script, you know.
Yeah.
And then that was my first big blow up. And then obviously as you live more, you're going to see that happens. It tends to happen more. And I think it's your ability to adapt. I mean, Didn't they say intelligence is your ability to adapt to change? That's really the extreme measure of intelligence, or somebody. Somebody said that. Somebody intelligent said that. Or maybe they said something that's like that. That's more intelligent than what I'm saying. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's really all about it. It's really all about adaption. Acceptance, acceptance, acceptance.
But, you know, the trouble with something like that is, I would have to imagine, is that, I mean, because my, you know, I've definitely had people in my life die from suicide. I was also a person who thought that I was probably going to die from suicide. And it is one of those things where, I mean, sometimes you can find your way around it, but it's not a rational thing. So you can't reason with those feelings, whether you're the one having them or whether you're the person left on the other end going, what the fuck just happened?
My dad, you know, in his letter, he's like, this is what they do in Japan when they're bitten and they don't do well. Successful. You know, and they do. They kill themselves.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, A, we're not Japanese. And B, we're not Japanese.
Yeah.
But, you know, to him, I guess that made sense. And of course it did. You know, he grew up in a hyper-masculine world in South Philadelphia, you know, where Italian men took care of the family.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what. And I also think there was a lot of pride. I think he didn't want to be around because he felt that because things didn't work out the way he wanted them to, he would be invalid.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing I learned from him, from this death, was pride.
Yeah.
Pride. He was not egotistical, but he was certainly proud.
Yeah.
But he always had to look a certain way in church. Always about, you know, because he grew up in a shitty family. Not a shitty family, shitty background. I wasn't there, but he grew up with, you know, an alcoholic father and my grandmother. And she used to yell every night a lot. Yeah, also, there was love there. My grandparents were cool. I loved them, but I do know it wasn't the greatest thing. So I think my dad, like, wanted his kids' lives to be this Norman Rockwell kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got to the point where my mother was like, your father's business isn't doing well, telling us while we're in high school, like, this house has got to go, and she tried to sell it, and they would have made a lot of coin because they built it for nothing, and they put all this stuff into it, and it really increased the value. But to him, that was his dream, was his house. And once he lost, I think he was going to take his life then, but apparently my mother talked him out of it then. And, but, you know, his death really did teach me a lot.
Yeah.
About what's important. I mean, I'm certainly nowhere near where I want to be in my career by any stretch, but I'm happy with what I've done. I'm happy with what I'm doing, and I don't care what happens anymore. I had to let go of that. Because I looked around and, you know, I was like, this really, when I remember when I was a little boy, I went to go see the cemetery, because Italians, when somebody dies, my grandmother died when I was 6.
Yeah.
So my grandfather bought her plot in the cemetery, and you go, all the Italians go to the cemetery after church, right? So we used to go to the cemetery all the time. And I remember looking around when I was like a little boy, walking down throughout the weeds my father gave me around the cemetery plot, you know, to throw them out in the garbage can, and I'd see all these stones on the ground and be like, there are people under the ground by these stones. I don't even know who any of these people are. And I'm looking at names, I'm like, I don't know who that person is, another. And I got so scared. I'm like, I don't want to die and not have anybody know who I am. Oh my God. I need to make sure people know who I am. You know, and that was like, that was the beginning of this root inside of you. Like, you need to do great, amazing things. And it was always about being the funniest guy at the party or booking the role or, you know, and it was very competitive for me for a very long time. And I was competitive and I did accomplish a lot. And if I didn't, I was a bitch about it. You know, it was, it was crazy. But now, I'm at the point where I'm like, I don't give a shit if nobody knows who I am. In fact, I don't even want to be fucking buried. Burn my house up and smoke me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it took a lot for me to get to that point, you know, where I'm like, oh, well, you know?
Well, and you also worked really hard to take care of yourself and to get yourself, you struggled pretty publicly with weight for a while, and then you made a decision, and you just, you went for
it.
Well, no,
there was
no struggle. Hard as fuck.
I loved being fat.
Oh, yeah.
I adored being fat. It was a lot of fun being fat. And I wasn't, you know, severely obese, but I certainly was overweight. And I'm a tall guy, and I wore the weight of my shape. It definitely helped me out a lot with rolls.
Yeah.
But my back kept going out. I would still be fat if it was healthy. But my back kept going out. My heart, you know, my blood pressure was up. My ribs would pop out of place sometimes. How the hell does that happen? And I honestly thought I just needed to lose a few pounds.
Yeah.
I lost 85 pounds in 5.5 months.
Oh, I remember.
Simply by altering what I ate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a huge deal.
Yeah.
Only because it was a big identity crisis. Like, people did not know who I was anymore. Auditions were so weird. I kept telling my agents, you can't send me out on fat guy parts. I mean, I was super skinny.
Yeah.
And they saw me, but the casting directors had a hard time. Like, once you're in the mindset of this business a certain way, it's hard for them to break out of that. And you can't really blame them because there's so many people. There's so many roles that need to be filled. And, you know, so it was hard. And then the recession hit. People weren't really going to the movies as much, or movies sort of stopped, were beginning to really suck, and, you know, TV shows and stuff. I mean, it was just like, I lost all this weight. I looked super different. I was getting older. I wasn't going out as much. I thought it was over. And then I ended up doing a bunch of commercials for Subway.
Yeah, I remember those.
That sort of got me back. And one of their spots I did for them was, they said one of the best commercials they've ever had that was well received is one where I slipped on the grease.
Yeah.
And I legitimately, they're like, you need to slip on grease as a burger manager of some joint, slip on this grease. And I said, okay, well, grease it up and I'll really do it. That's the only way it's going to look right. And they greased it up.
Yeah.
And I really slipped, fell into something like I normally would. And, you know, it looked just terrible. And people loved it. So, you know, I was in pain for a while, but it was worth it. And they brought me back to do a couple more. So it's almost like every time I think I'm done, I've done everything, I end up booking something and come back. So.
Well, there's nothing wrong with reinvention. But, I mean, figuring out more things about who you are, how you are, what kind of a person you are, what kind of person you want to be. All of those things are part of the process. And if you're not changing something about yourself every once in a while, I think that you can stagnate.
Oh, God, yeah. And you can get super – it's almost petrifying because you're like, is this it? This is it? This is how good it's going to get. Like, you know, when Jack, I always think of Nicholson, and as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And he, like, steps out of the elevator, and he's like, is this as good as it fucking gets, you know? but I've learned to stop saying that because it changes.
Yeah.
It, like, your life, at least mine, because it is very sporadic. I've not had a normal job ever. I've always had acting gigs and small side gigs or something, you know. And I mean, for 10 years, I dressed up at kids' birthday parties.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a SpongeBob for many years, and Pikachu. I don't even know what the hell Pikachu is. But
in clowning. You did clowning for a number of years.
That would be a clown too, yeah. You know, but it was good money, and I could still hang out with my friends and make a good living, and it was fine. But my life is, I don't know where I'm going to be 5 years. Maybe I'll still be here. Who knows? But I also don't care.
Right.
I think that's like mental illness, and I know that's what this is all about. And we talked about my dad and whatnot, and he was on some kind of meds, and then I don't know if he stopped taking them abruptly, which isn't the best thing to do, and that may have caused it. But I had a feeling he was planning this for a long time, because it was pretty well planned out. You know what I mean? He had lied to everyone about where he was and what was going on, and so yeah. When my mom came home and she saw all the stuff, she was just like, whoa. But anyway, long story short, mental illness is, I don't really, you know, they're just scratching the surface of it,
yeah.
In my opinion. You know, my family members back in the 70s were put on lithium, which I don't think they would ever put anybody on now.
Oh,
you
God,
know,
no.
In homosexuality was considered a disease, a mental disease, up until the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, it still may be in some southern states.
Well,
but,
I mean, the current administration, that might make a comeback.
Oh, yeah, they're totally.
You know, nothing like a classic.
We're talking about mentally unfit, but that's a whole other show. But I think they're just scratching the surface, and I think you have to treat mental illness like you would treat somebody who with cancer or somebody, you know, with a broken leg or, you know, leukemia or whatever. It's a disease. And that mental illness, the symptoms of that could be anything from addiction to depression. You know, it's just, we have scratched the surface on what makes us who we are and why. And right. When someone is stuck in that position of, I'm so depressed, my dad died, I was so depressed, everything hurt. I couldn't pinpoint where the pain was. It just hurt all over. And I can totally appreciate wanting that pain to end, no matter what the cause. If it meant I ended, fine, as long as the pain ended.
Yeah.
That's where people are.
Yeah, it just colors people's reality completely to the point where there's nothing left but, you know, this film that's over everything else.
Yes, and it can happen to anybody at any time, rich or poor. But you know what? It's so funny. I mean, Kate Spade had just passed. She took her life.
Yeah.
And I got a couple of black comedian friends that I adore. Black women are my favorite people in the world. And one of them was like, why is she going to kill herself on Facebook and, you know, tell her daughter to ask her daddy why this happened? She goes, why would you do that? And you know, and I wrote back to her and I said, you know, just so you know, like, she wasn't in her right frame of mind. When somebody does that, they think what they're doing is the right thing and that everyone wants them to do it. Or maybe they don't want, but they know at the end, like, it'll be the best thing. And then she's like, well, you know, black people don't kill themselves. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm sure there are black people who have killed themselves. But majority of people kill themselves are white men in their 50s. My dad was 54.
Yeah.
Women, it happens every 17 minutes, maybe quicker now. I mean, this was my dad died almost 18 years ago. That's what they told me.
Yeah.
You know, at 17 minutes, somebody takes their life. But I think it's because of, and I mean, someone's going to go crazy when I say this, but white privilege. You know, like I said, everything in my life was going right. I watched other TV shows. I watched the movies where the hero, who was normally white, always ended up having everything work out for him in the end, whether it was a cartoon, a TV show, or Indiana Jones. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's what white people are taught. Oh, just work hard. It'll be fine. So when you do work hard and it isn't fine, they get mad and they don't understand. And that's where their privilege affects their cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas a black person is told from the get-go, from the day they're born, a black parent will tell a black child at whatever point that, look, you're black. Life's going to be a lot more difficult for you than white people.
Right.
And I know this is true because the black women that I know told me they said this to their kids. I mean, there's this family up in Westlake Village, or all the way up the 101, there's this really expensive, there's a ton of expensive suburbs in L.A., up north of L.A. And in one of the suburbs up there, I read an article where this black neighbor had to take her black son around to all the white neighbors and say, this is my son. If you see him in my house, please don't shoot him or call the cops.
Jesus
Christ.
And
she legitimately had to do that, not as a joke, because she felt she needed to.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's pretty fucked up when you hear a story like that and you go, you know, that's good thinking.
What's that?
It's pretty fucked up when you hear a story like that and you go, you know, that's good thinking.
Yeah,
it is. Way to be proactive.
You know? And another problem with mental illness is it prevents you from empathizing, I think, with other people and understanding, because you're so focused. It's so selfish, not in a negative way.
Yeah.
But mental illness causes you to focus on your bad thing. We have these minds that continually, this is why I believe in Eckhart Tolle, who talks about the ego constantly needing reaffirmation that it's alive, that it's around, and the best way it's reaffirmed is through negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm too this. I'm too that. If only this. If only that. That, if that didn't happen, then all those ideas, all those thoughts knock you down further and further. And you can't say, well, I'm just going to stop thinking those thoughts, because what if you resist persists. So if you force yourself to stop thinking there's a negative, all you're going to end up doing is persisting. They're going to persist. They're going to keep yelling at you in your mind. So
yeah.
You basically have to accept them, not say they're true. I shouldn't say accept. The better word is acknowledge that these voices, or this voice in your head, are telling you these things about yourself, and ignore them.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that it's almost impossible to do.
It does get really hard. I mean, one of the things that I would tell people once in a while is, you know, because I stopped taking medication several years ago for, you know, various reasons. I wanted to, you know, I think honestly it was probably the illness likes to tell you that you're not being your full self if you're on medicine.
Yeah.
And so you trick yourself into thinking, you know, well, I can ride this out. But I've been riding it out for a while, you know, 10 years or so. And it's funny because those thoughts still come to me. Like I'll be standing on a train platform and I'll go, you know, you could jump. I mean, it's the same thing as saying, you know, you could go catch a unicorn. I mean, they're both about as likely, but the thoughts don't go away. They come with me. They just don't seem like an option anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you know you're, I guess, for lack of a better word, well, is when you're able to say, you know what, this doesn't serve me.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're going to, it's not like you may get to the point where you say this doesn't serve me, but then there might be one day where it's really hard. And
yeah.
It causes you to come to that. Because you think you're going to have good days and bad days. And then when you have bad days, at least in my opinion, then you think, oh God, I can't do this like I thought. And you have to go, no. And this is what I do. No, you can do this. You know you're going to say you can't do this, so just say it, and then keep doing it. And then honestly, and this is something new I've been doing, it stops.
Yeah.
Because I've taken it out of my head that I can't do it. You know, I told my mom the other day that people are lazy because they're insecure.
Yes.
Somebody doesn't do something, it's not because they don't want to do it. They don't think they'll be able to do it properly, so they don't do it.
Yeah.
And... or they say they'll do it later. I mean, I know because I'm a human being and these are the fucking operations. It won't be done right. You know, somebody else could do it better. So I'm just not going to do it. And you and I could sit there and say, but you know you have to do it. But saying it and doing it are two different things.
Right.
That's why I'm saying we have barely touched the surface of how mental illness affects us. And what degree of mental illness there are, and the stigma, because you may have a slight mental illness, you know.
Yeah.
I know I have OCD. That is that's an illness, and that was something I've had to learn how to live with. But the problem with OCD is that as you get older, it sort of morphs itself into different things in your life, and it hides itself.
Yeah.
So you think you don't have OCD, and then before you know it. You realize it pretty much dictated the majority of the last 5 years of your life.
I was just talking about that. I had a little bit of that myself. Well, I say I had a little bit of that, like I picked it off the buffet. But I didn't realize that I had certain obsessive thought patterns and tendencies until I moved out here to Colorado. And when I moved in with my girlfriend, it was like, I would run a stopwatch for literally everything I did so that I knew how long it took. And if I didn't run the stopwatch, it drove me crazy. And one day she asked me what I was doing and, you know, I told her, oh yeah, I forgot to start the stopwatch. So now I have no idea how long it's going to take me to get from the bedroom to the car. And she just stared at me for a minute and said, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, you know, like you do.
People think you're crazy, but to you it makes sense. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
But I had to have had to have it put in front of me before I recognized, oh, this might be aberrant.
Well, that's
this
it.
Might be a little
I mean,
strange.
Recognition. What do they say? The first step to recovery is acknowledge and recognition.
Yeah.
Okay, this is who I am. You know how hard it is for people to sit back and go, I'm in the wrong here because I do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And because I do X, Y, and Z, A, B, and C happen. I mean, it's so hard for people to do that because then it feeds into that and those negative thoughts.
Yeah.
You have to be able to accept the positive, accept the negative, and move on. I have an uncle, he's Buddhist, his big fan. My dad died, I talked to him a lot. He's a friend of the family. He's my dad's best friend, one of his best friends. He was kind of upset too, so he felt like he could help me, sort of help out my dad, you know. But he was, his whole process, like, you don't get too happy, you don't get too sad. You got to go through life like on a boat and stay as steady as possible. It's true. you know?
Yeah.
Because I'm definitely, I have a tendency to be, you know, to go to extremes, no question. You know, if I discover something, I'll go crazy on it. And I could be very angry. I could be very happy. And these are not healthy emotions to go to extremes. And now I'm really learning to just try to be more pragmatic and practical about my feelings.
Yeah.
Why did I do this? But you know, you have to live. I had an acting teacher in college say most people shouldn't really act until they're like really old. Not old, but older. Because right. That's life experience. You know, and it's the same thing with like, I had to live for 43 years to go back and start to really critically think of the patterns that I did in my life that were not necessarily the most positive and notice when those patterns happen so that I can go, oh, okay, now this might happen. I might start to think this because I did. You start to recognize them.
Yeah.
But you have to go through them enough before you can recognize them.
Well, you've certainly gone through a whole hell of a lot of things, and that's going to force you to do one of two things. It's going to make you either dig in to all of the negative yeah. habits that you have and solidify them until you're just, you know, bitter, or it's going to make you think about it and try to do something about it. And it seems like that's what you've done.
Well, I'm trying. I mean, I definitely have days where I'm worse than others, but lately I've really just been trying to like stay on this boat.
Well, trying is good.
Life is so.
Well, I mean, yeah, what more do you need, right? It's sometimes trying is all you
true.
Got. I mean, as long as you're still moving, that's not nothing.
It's very true. It's very true.
Plus, I mean, you know, you got a good guy in your life, and your mom. I mean, Jesus Christ, God love your mom.
Isn't mom great?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I love your mom.
Yeah, but then there's that, you know, there's that sense that I'm like, I feel like, thank you, man, I appreciate that. But out of my dad on, I kind of feel like an added sense of, okay, I've got to make sure, you know, mom is okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are moments like that. I'm sorry. My husband just told me we have his detergent to wash clothes, and I'm just like, what? But I feel the guilt sometimes that I need to help my mother because my dad's not around. They did have a full-on true marriage. I mean, they loved each other.
Yeah.
But I also have to step back sometimes and go, you know, you also have your life to live. And it's not like she's, where are we going? What are we doing? You know, she's not like that at all. But I feel like I want to make sure she's okay. My dad would want me to, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think you basically have to work with what you've got. And that's easier said than done, I know, but that's really what it's all about. Period.
Well, I think that's a good place to end.
And I agree, because I have to head off to an audition, my friend. But it was a pleasure talking to you, dude.
It was really great talking to you, Michael. I goddamn love you. You're one of the bright spots in this universe. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Same here, dude. Same here. Of course. Anytime, let me know. And be safe, be well, and I'll talk to your ass soon. See you on Facebook, bitch. All right. Or Instagram. Or whatever the hell we're on. All right, brother. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
And there you have it, folks. You know, a conversation full of ups and downs. Just like everything else in life, right? You can find him anywhere you would find a person who you're looking to find out what they're doing. He's on the IMDb. You can check out his full list of credits there, and I urge you to seek out his stuff. He is amazing. He's funny. He's talented. The People versus George Lucas, 6 Feet Under. I could go on and on, but I'm not going to, because this is the end of the show. This is where everything wraps up in a nice little bow, and we get to feel good about it. So that's what we're going to do this week. And you know what? If everything doesn't go the way that it's supposed to, so what? Don't kill yourself out there. I mean it.